No Direction and Paizo team up to bring you the Gen Con 2018 seminar coverage. No Direction would like to thank our advertising sponsor, the Roll for Combat Starfinder Actual Play Podcast. Listen at rollforcombat.com.
Hi, everybody.
Hello.
Welcome to Secrets of Galarion. That's what you're all here for, right?
No.
All right. Well, if you're not here for that, I guess that's what you're here for now. Hi, everybody. My name is Linda Zayas Palmer. I am a developer at Paizo. I work primarily on Pathfinder Society organized play. I do both the role-playing guild side and the adventure card guild side. So if any of you haven't had a chance to check out the games over in the Sagamore, I highly recommend it. We have so many dedicated volunteers who are running these games, and without them, like, none of this could go. So
thank you, volunteers.
Thank you, volunteers who are here right now.
Or watching this later on the Twitch.
And who are watching this later on Twitch, yes. And how about we introduce the rest of us as well? Adam?
All right. I'm Adam Daigle. I'm managing developer for Pathfinder.
And I'm Mark Moreland. I am the franchise manager for Paizo, which means that I coordinate with our marketing and licensing teams to ensure that there's brand cohesion between what we're producing and what our licensees are doing.
And also, Mark is, before he was staff, he was a big fan nerd that put together the Pathfinder Wiki.
So he has a
So I'm the resident guy who knows all the secrets. If not the secrets, then where to find the answers.
So, speaking of secrets, there's one thing I wanted to say right up at the top. There's certain secrets in the setting that are really like those fundamental secrets, like what happened to Aerdyn,
or he died.
What is the cause of the gap? Or those sorts of things.
That's Starfinder. I don't know.
Starfinder, it's still related to Galarion. It says Secrets of Galarion, not Secrets of Pathfinder.
You're right.
So we're not going to be answering like those fundamental to the setting sorts of questions. But beyond that, we're interested in what you would like to hear from us.
And we can explore any sort of like behind the scenes, like what were some of the inspirations for certain things if we happen to know them.
Yeah, if people want to know some of the out of world, you know, not the in-world secrets, but the secrets about the secrets, you know. So every year it seems like we get people who ask, why won't you tell us what the test of the Starstone is? Mm-hmm. And so I guess I'll answer that. the fundamental secrets that Linda mentioned, they're key to telling a story without protagonists. In a novel or a movie, they can reveal the secrets because they are, you know, the authors, the showrunners, whomever, know the journey that the protagonists are taking and can mold their reaction to and their discovery of the truths that lie at the foundation of the world. And we can't do that because all of the players are the protagonists in the stories that we tell. So we have to maintain those secrets, one, so that GMs have something they can make their own. And if a GM wants to answer that question, they're free to do so without worrying that they're violating the sacrosanct canon that everyone must follow. Or so that players have big questions that motivate them to become adventurers. If all of the doors are labeled, why do you need to open any doors to see what's on the other side? So that's really our philosophy with secrets. And generally, when we answer an existing question, we always try and make sure that we're asking two more or setting up two more mysteries so that we never paint ourselves into a corner, or more importantly, paint GMs and players into corners, because there's no more exploration to do.
Yes, we have a question over here.
There is a 16th level wizard that lives on the sun. How does that happen? Has that ever been talked about?
So the question for the audience online is, there is a 16th level wizard who lives on the sun. How does that happen? Has that ever been talked about?
Magic. It certainly came up, especially when we were doing some of the early designs for the Pact Worlds for Starfinder. I know that it was discussed, like, hey, is that guy still there? Did he, you know, survive the gap? And is he a mystery that's carrying over? And the eventual decision was, we want to have as few linking threads between Pathfinder and Starfinder in case we ever do a Sun adventure path or module in Pathfinder that deals with that guy. We don't want to have closed ourselves off from telling that story. So that's certainly one that we might explore. And we have a whole Starfinder adventure path coming up that takes place in and around the Sun, so it's entirely possible for GMs to use that as inspiration for their own Pathfinder Sun Wizard story. Anyone else? Yes.
Maybe it's not a secret, perhaps, but I was wondering if you could give me some background information on the archetype of synthesis.
Maybe it's not a question per se, but I was wondering if you could give me some background on the archetype of synthesis.
Yeah.
The synthesis summoner.
Yes.
Yeah. So that was one of Rob McCreary's, wasn't it?
I think so.
Yeah, just about one of the secrets of Galarian is that anything that's broken was probably designed by Rob McCreary.
That's not entirely true.
Okay.
There just happens to be synthesis summoners and
Zen archers.
And the snowball spell.
Yeah. all of which created very large internet controversies, at least on our message boards. So I don't know really what the inspiration for it was. I mean, I think that when we came up with the idea of the summoner, and this was before any of us worked at Paizo, not long before, but before, the idea was always, the original inspiration was more similar to what the Unchained Summoner is, in the sense that you're making a bond with a specific type of outsider, from one of the planes, instead of this sort of build your own monster thing that doesn't really adhere to any of the, you know, planar archetypes that we have in our setting. And one of the things that I think we all sort of thought we wanted to do with it was, well, why not have you be able to meld with your Eidolon? And I mean, it was a popular choice. People loved it, not only because it's broken, but because it's a lot of fun, you know, to be the wizard or summoner, but the wizard archetype, the wizard type character that suddenly, like, got demon powers. That's pretty cool. So, it was just sort of to fill that narrative hole that the class allowed us to fill.
As far as we know.
Yeah.
As far as we know, Rob. I mean, if you find Rob, it was probably outlined and assigned by Jason or Steven or Sean. But you might even ask Rob. I mean, there might be a specific piece of fiction or show that he was thinking of when he designed it that we don't know because Rob is a puzzle box. into which we cannot glance.
But that's why
the archetype came out when we were there. Maybe not you.
When you were there.
Okay, I was definitely there when it came out.
No.
In any case, yeah.
Right there in Buck?
So I'm really interested in a lot of the occult classes and a lot of the occult type lore. And so the little like teasers that got brought out about ancient Assyrian, like the city of Shotep Kara,
So that was a bit of a long question. I'm trying to remember all the parts of it to repeat it for the Twitch audience. But you're asking about the history of Old Arcerian and its connection to the occult classes,
yeah,
and the mystery of Shotep Kara, and places like that.
And how it was teased that it might be related to the planet Octurn, and there's some mysterious goings on, but nothing more than that.
and how it was teased that it might be related to the planet Octurn, and there's mysterious goings on around that.
Yeah. Okay.
So,
what would you say if I told you everything's connected to Octurn? Not really, but what would you say? I don't know. I don't know. You developed Doomsday Dawn. Is there anything?
Well, I mean, Doomsday Dawn, the playtest adventure, specifically deals with Octurn and the countdown clocks.
The Octurn, which is called the Octurn Enigma.
Yeah.
Yes.
So there is some. There's definitely some more information than that. So I definitely suggest picking that up and looking at it.
Yeah, but
it's
because
also,
it's... go ahead.
Oh, sorry. It's also connected to the Pathfinder Society scenario, Oath of the Overwatched. Well, it was one of those ones where I was talking to James Jacobs as that one was coming together and being like, okay, to what extent do we want to hint at, like, maybe this is connected to this old enigma? But if you look at the handouts and the information that's provided in there, that's connected both back to the older adventure, Voice in the Void, and also to this whole broader Octurn Enigma mystery.
Yeah, I mean, as to how it connects, how the Octurn Enigma specifically connects to occult classes, because we're exploring that in playtest material, for the most part, other than the scenario Linda mentioned, there's not going to be a lot of direct connection to, you know, mesmerists and occultists, simply because those aren't in the playtest. But a lot of our inspiration for the occult classes came from real-world occultism around real-world ancient cultures. And so that's the reason that one of the very earliest organizations that we ever detailed in Galarian was the Palatine Order of the... Esoteric Order of the Palatine Eye, which is sort of a Masonic order that... is just sort of obsessed with ancient Osirian, and they do things like have mummy dust parties where they open up a sarcophagus and see what's inside, and then they all sort of like drink the red liquid to you know, since that's the thing that's going around the internet now, is drinking the red liquid in the strange sarcophagus. They would do that because they think that doing so would connect them to the power of the ancient god kings of Osirian or something like that. So they're a very occult-oriented organization that existed long before we had rules for occult classes that have a link to Osirian. So the same way that real-world occultists like Aleister Crowley and folks like that look to Egyptian mythology or visuals or whatever for some of their inspiration, we did the same thing, and so that leaves a lot of room for exploration of that in Osirian.
And do you happen to remember, Moreland, which campaign setting book it was that touched on some of those things with ancient Osirian and the Octurn Enigma?
There's a little bit of it in The Slave Trenches of Hakotep, which is the fifth volume of The Mummy's Mask Adventure Path. That has a countdown clock, if I recall, because it was written by Michael Cortez, who sort of invented the Octurn Enigma. Mm-hmm. The
Occult Mysteries?
Occult Mysteries.
I think it's Occult Mysteries.
Yeah, Occult Mysteries has a little bit about that. That's in the Pathfinder campaign setting line. And then we also have Occult Realms, which I feel like had something in Osirian in it, but I can't recall specifically what off the top of my head. In any case, there's some stuff there. Mm-hmm. Does that cover your question?
I was kind of hoping to see if there was, you know, more in the works to touch on other places. But
Doomsday Dawn is the thing that's in the works or newly released as of today. But as far as I know, we don't have plans for something in the not within the next 12 months. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we kind of like, if we were going to dig deeper into any sort of Osirian stuff, we would have done that during the Mummy's Mask AP. And since that wasn't that long ago, I don't think we're going to dip back into that well anytime immediate.
But it is an iconic adventure trope to do the pyramid delving desert adventure, and so you know, in 12 months we're going to be launching a new edition, and what we do after that, we may decide to go back to that well sooner rather than later, simply to cover that trope earlier in the edition than we might have in first edition. Although Entombed with the Pharaohs was one of the first modules.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it looks like we have a question from the internet.
Yes, so from Twitch, Stunt Monkey asks, will we find out anything more about Nex, or where Nex went, or what happened to Nex?
So that was, will we find out anything more about Nex, or where Nex went, or what happened to him?
Yes. I guess
okay,
I should elaborate.
For this one, you've got to do two things. You've got to find Eric Mona.
Mm-hmm.
Good luck.
And you've got to convince him to write something.
Good luck.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, Nex is Eric's baby. He's Eric's Elminster, in the sense that he knows everything about that character and his history, and he's also the head of our editorial department and our publisher. So he gets to tell us not to play with it. That, you know, he has sort of put his markers in the sand around that one and said, Nex is mine. Every year we say, hey, Eric, is this the year that you're going to do Nex? Mm-hmm. People have been asking for Nex. So at some point we will either, you know... Mm-hmm.
And I know he's eager.
He just doesn't have the time. And I know that we've got a few things in the works that I don't think we've ever nailed down and said, yes, this is a product we're producing, but it's certainly something that we discuss.
Yeah.
I think the most recent thing that we published that had Nex adjacent stuff, there have been a few scenarios that you guys did with the invasion of Absalom, right?
We've done some scenarios with that, and not Nex himself, but at least set in Nex. One of those three playtest scenarios, Arc Lord's Envy, is set in Nex. So that was sort of a, hey, can we set a scenario here? And then so it's definitely moving in the direction of starting to reveal more about what's going on.
Eric's getting a little less territorial about it because he recognizes he needs to, you know, do his business or get off the pot, and so we'll have something with that. And he's done a little bit with Nex in the Pathfinder Worldscape comics, which take place in a demiplane created by Nex, where he draws heroes from across time and across worlds. He draws them from three worlds: Galarian, a place called Barsoom, and a place that the Barsoomians call Jassoom, which we call Earth. And so he pulls those heroes from those three locations into the worldscape, where his original plan was to amass all these heroes from these three worlds across time and then unleash like shadow copies of them. If they were in the worldscape, they'd be able to, he could control fake versions of them and send, you know, John Carter and Red Sonja and Tarzan to attack Absalom so he could take it that way. But he disappeared, and so this demiplane has sort of been running on its own now for who knows how long, because time doesn't exist there. Currently there have been 14 issues taking place there, 10 of which are compiled in hardcover, you know, trades that you can get that have a little bit of about Nex in the back matter, but he's not one of the protagonists of the stuff, of the story itself. So, mm-hmm.
Over here.
Me?
Yes, you.
I'm running a venture path, Hell's Rebels, and so we just a little while ago did the City of Rye. I actually think it's a really cool concept for a city. Like that you can't kill people, there's like four or five people that run it, and then like underground, like I guess the prison itself was built on like a demon type place. Are you guys going to do any more with that city thing? Or is that something you guys probably don't think about? I just thought it was a really cool city that was like a side note in that adventure.
So the question is, are we going to do anything more with the City of Rye from Hell's Rebels?
City of Vyre, I think.
Vyre?
Is that how you say it?
Yeah, V-Y-R-E.
I hope so, because that place is a horrible den of debauchery.
Right.
which is fun to play stories.
Like Indy
in.
During Gen Con.
No.
Different kind of
no.
debauchery.
Yeah.
No, I've always enjoyed it, and when James was outlining and developing that adventure path, like, he and I had a lot of conversations about it, and it, so we kind of, like, developed it in his office, just, like, telling stories back and forth, like, oh, well, this, you know.
What if it does
this
and, oh, and yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Which, is also.
Which is how we do it, just about everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. One of the neat, bits of, history about Vire from a real world perspective is the fact that that was just literally a name drop. It was something that I think Rich Pett mentioned in Sin's in Skinsaw Murders, which was the second Pathfinder Adventure Path volume, as Justice Ironbriar's birthplace, maybe someone who was in the Skinsaw cult, having been from there. And he was just like, so-and-so is from Vire in Cheliax. And whoever wrote the Cheliax gazetteer section, which was probably Eric, and whoever did that first Cheliax 32-page book didn't know that there was a city called Vire there, because it had only ever been mentioned in passing in a completely different context. And so that's one of those things that I don't know whether I was working for Paizo yet or if I was still a fan, but I was like, hey James, where's Vire? And that's what working with me is like.
Yeah. It's true.
And
it's
he
not
was,
a secret.
And he was like, what are you talking about? I was like, the city of Vire in Cheliax, where Justice Ironbriar is from. And he was like, what? And I pulled out the book and pointed to it, and he was like, oh, I guess we should decide where it is. So we decided where it was, and it grew into being like the birthplace of Norgorber, you know, one of the four ascended gods, and it's like a super holy city for him. And it started out as literally a word that probably half a dozen people read on a page and didn't gloss over to look for the next stat block. So,
you know. Yeah, I especially love that it's Norgorber's birthplace.
Yeah, yeah. Which makes sense that you can't kill anyone there because that's his job.
Yeah.
I see one in the front over here.
The Baba Yaga adventure path coincided very nicely with, you know, we hit the year where she was coming back to pick the next successor. Is there any significant date that we should be looking forward to in the next couple of years that's coincidentally rolling around? Or any something?
Well, to bring up Doomsday Dawn again, it happens to be on a rather convenient year.
Yeah. And to repeat the question, it was that the Reign of Winter adventure path took place in a very convenient year for the continuity of the setting. And for those who don't know, we set the real world date or the in-world date moves forward 1 year in conjunction with real time passing here. So the current year in Galarian, or the assumed time that currently published things are assumed to take place, is 4718. So you can always just add 47 in front of the
in
last
two, for 2000.
Yeah, yeah, instead of 2000 to the year. So what year did that come out? It would have been 2014. Okay. So within the setting, we had said that basically every 100 years on the 14s, for whatever reason, I think it's probably just random, Baba Yaga comes back to replace the queen in Irisen. And so in 2014, we released an adventure path that's about the PCs getting enmeshed in the conflict between the current queen and Baba Yaga, who wants to replace her. And then the final part of the question was, what years should we look forward to in the future? And yeah.
I mean, Doomsday Dawn has as a fundamental premise that something terrible is supposed to happen in 4718, and that is one of the sort of like, hey, wait a minute. That's also a significant year for us. Maybe we can have this adventure that's about preventing something cataclysmic and terrible coming about be something that people can do as the playtest adventure. And one of the nice things about that in the context of the playtest adventure is that it's something where each part is a different level. And that final part is for 17th level characters, right? So you can really get up into that world-shaking consequences level. But the other parts also all have their role to play in the story as well, just as much.
Yeah. I think that other games have, when they've done addition changes, have drastically altered the setting. And we figured that if we were going to do that, we wanted to do it on screen so people can at least see the change happen instead of just reading about it in a book. And it was, again, just a coincidence that when we were coming up with ideas of, you know, what's a thing that we could show on screen that's potentially cataclysmic if the PCs fail, that also happens in 4718, and it was just coincidence that that's when the countdown clocks were pointing to. So there are probably things that are counting down to 4719 or 4720. I can't think of any.
One of the things is, like, that was something that was really common in the early days of the campaign setting, where there were a lot of, like, number drops and things looking forward. Because, honestly, I think, like, when those guys were really building that at the beginning, they were just like, is this going to take off? I don't know. Yeah. So
they were like, it's going to happen 10 years from now, and then we don't ever have to worry about it. Because
now I see it more as, like, a potential, like, landmine. Of some, like, if I drop something like that and don't carry through, then that's worse than actually pinpointing a date in my eyes.
It's like the words always and never are extremely dangerous words, because then you're boxing the GM into the corner if you say this sort of NPC always does this, or people here always do this, or people here never do this, and then it's like, well, wait, what if I want to take my story in a different direction? So I saw a hand back here as well.
So in Starfighter, one part of the premise is that Galarian is missing, but is the perfect copy of Galarian in Avadar's First Fall also missing?
Hmm.
That's an interesting question. He asked, with the gap, Galarian is missing in Starfinder, but is the perfect copy of Galarian in Avadar's vault also missing?
And if it's not, when do we steal it?
When do we steal it?
Yeah. Or if it is, when do we steal it, you mean? Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah,
that sounds like an awesome idea for an adventure, doesn't it?
Perfect copy of Galarian.
Yeah, I mean,
Avadar's vault. Just give me a moment here.
Yeah, is Avadar still around in Starfinder?
Yes.
He is one of them, right? He is one of the ones that carried over.
Even has a corporation.
He does.
Yeah,
that's Avadar right. Corp. Avadar Corp. Okay.
Yeah.
Duh. All right. So that's an interesting question. And, we have said that the gods know where Galarian is, or some of them do at least, and that they're not saying where it is other than the fact that it's safe. So maybe it's safe in his vault. I don't know. He's got one and he's got a spare.
Galarian contained perfection in it.
Yeah, it could be any number of things. So, again, that's one of those core questions that everyone in the Pact Worlds, at the very least, has in their mind. In the same way that in the real world, what's a real world mystery?
D.B. Cooper.
Yeah, where is that guy?
Probably rotting in the Pacific Northwest woods.
Yeah, he's probably stuck up in a tree somewhere. So we probably won't answer it, just because we have to go back to the drawing board of, okay, what's the core mystery of this setting? But that doesn't mean that we won't do an adventure that deals heavily with people exploring that possibility and potentially finding maybe what they find in Avadar's vault isn't a replica of Galarian. It's just a very detailed blueprint of Galarian.
Avadar's vault would be an amazing adventure.
Avadar's vault would really just be like, oh no, you thought that you were, you know, like a Truman Show type thing, like, oh, you thought you were in Absalom. No, this is just Vault Absalom. What? A Pathfinder Starfinder crossover is something we could do, yes. I don't think anyone has plans for that. I mean, I've suggested it for, like, the comics of, like, hey, let's do a thing. And every time it's been like, we're not crossing the streams.
I put a Starfinder Easter egg into one of the volumes of Ruins of Aslan, and no one picked it up.
I did.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Marlin counts as a person. Come on, Abel.
Yeah. I'll talk to HR about this if you don't think I'm a person.
So, all the way in the back in the green shirt.
So, with Galeria missing, was there going to be anything involving Rovagug in Starfinder?
So, the question is, with Galeria missing, is there going to be anything involving Rovagug in Starfinder?
Because Galeria is supposed to be his jail cell.
It is his jail cell, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The cage.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that if Rovagug does show up in a Starfinder product, that might provide some hints as to at least one event that happened during the gap. Because in Pathfinder, he hasn't escaped yet, and if he's escaped in Starfinder, then, okay, we know one thing that happened. He escaped. We don't know any details about it. Mm-hmm. But that is, again, I mean, that is the type of question that we want GMs to take and run with. And so you could have Rovagug show up and then have a whole adventure or a whole campaign about trying to figure out how he escaped and if discovering that will lead your PCs to Galarian, wherever it is. You know, that's sort of like a quest for the Holy Grail, a quest for Galarian type thing.
With your big kind of unanswerable questions, do you have sort of answers to those in your head as you're coming up with other ideas? Like, do you know what's going on, or do you leave that empty for yourself as well?
The question was, do we know what's going on? And the answer is no.
Hold on. There was more to his question. He was asking, when it comes to those big mysteries, do we ourselves know what the answers are and use those to inform what we do?
Oh, yes.
Whole Death of Aridin thing, there is, yes. Mm-hmm. Now, some of those answers can be in flux. Like, if a better solution comes along. But you do have to have some sort of, like, baseline, mm-hmm. so you don't either accidentally reveal something incorrect, or so you know, if those things rely upon that mystery, you need that structure to, in order to tell the other stories that may surround it. Mm-hmm. I know that one, but you know what? I don't even know the gap one. I've never asked.
I've asked the gap mm-hmm. one, and Rob won't tell me, and
I like it being a mystery,
but I'm just scared to death that, like, someone's gonna try and put in a comic or something that I'm in charge of maintaining continuity on where I don't have that answer. So one of the things that we do is spoil the secrets for ourselves so that they're not spoiled for players and GMs. Yeah, I like Daigle, like a few other people in the office, probably Rob, mm-hmm. definitely Eric, have sat down with James Jacobs, who's our creative director for Pathfinder, and have gone over what happened to Aridin and who the original gods were and what existed before the gods created this reality and where Zonkuthon, you know, came from, and you know, a lot of these, like, big questions, what are the nature of the Star Stone, things like that. We've made sure that everyone is at least on the same page, or the major decision makers are on the same page, so that when we're outlining a product or developing an adventure path or, you know, editing a novel or whatever, we can make sure that there's not some throwaway line that some author thinks that they're getting clever and saying, haha, I'm gonna say what happened to Aridin. Mm-hmm. Maybe we hint at that. We know the truth so that we can lead people in the right or wrong direction mm-hmm. as needed. And we've left a lot of Easter eggs. And I mean, if we were to ever say what happened to Aridin, and someone had read everything we've ever published and put all the pieces together, which I don't know if they would.
There was a thread about it, and somebody got real, real close.
Oh, well, right? You're right. that we've left Easter eggs throughout that in retrospect will be like a, you know, Kaiser Soze moment of like recognizing all of the times that you could have figured it out ahead of time, that we hope that would all come together. That there may never be a chance because we may never answer that. Until a bigger question than what happened to Aridin comes along, we probably won't answer that specific one.
And I think part of it, too, is that we all, you know, we all work together. We all communicate. And we all know what sort of those big things are that if you're going to get anywhere near that, you got to be sure that you talk to the people who know and run it past them to make sure that we keep that sort of consistency. And it's the same thing, too, with if somebody worked on something and then they dropped a big honking mystery in that adventure, then before you go to maybe answer that, you talk to them and be like, hey, were you planning on doing something with this? How does this go in? Are there any pieces of this that I need to know about before I deal with this sort of thing? So
and that gets harder.
You work on the internal.
Yeah, and that gets harder the more, you know, turnover there is. You know, every company has people who come and leave. And so it gets harder when people aren't at the company anymore. Like if there's a mystery about Ustalav, it was probably added by Wes, and Wes doesn't work at Paizo anymore. I mean, he just lives a few blocks away, and I know where he lives, and I have his number, and I'm sure he would love the opportunity.
His balcony is literally across from mine.
Yeah, so. Okay, yeah. I'm sure he would love to have the opportunity to nerd out about Ustalav again. But it does mean that if he says, oh yeah, I always intended for so-and-so to actually be the secret daughter of the Whispering Tyrant, then we can always go, all right, I'm glad you intended that. Did you ever say that explicitly in text? No? Okay, all right, great. And then we can go our own direction. So part of it is getting guidance from the people who asked the initial question. And then it's also just about really only being beholden to the printed word. And even then, you know, there's always ways around formerly dumb ideas.
Did I see a hand over here?
Yep.
Yes.
Once on the forums, I posted a question asking if a paladin could also be a Hell Knight, and that caused a huge amount of controversy and argument that just lasted forever. Luckily, James hopped into the post, and he answered it telling me yes, that he loved that idea and that it absolutely could happen. So what I'm wondering is, what do you guys think about a character that morally pulled in two different directions so strongly?
So the question was, once on the forums you were in a thread that was talking about whether, and you asked if whether a paladin could be a Hell Knight, and James Jacobs came in that thread and said that was a very interesting idea and that yes, that could be the case, and what do we think about that idea? I think it's interesting too. I mean, I like seeing sort of people who take a character concept and sort of play with it in an unexpected way. You know, as someone who is devoted to law and order. So I could see that it's sort of like you're lawful good, but maybe your focus is a bit more on the law, but you're still looking for another way to interpret this. I imagine it would also be one of those things where this is gonna work a lot better with some orders than others.
Yeah, the Order of the God Claw, for example, is the Hell Knight order that worships a pantheon of lawful gods that includes Asmodeus and Iomedae. So, as a paladin, you could certainly focus your worship on Iomedae, and maybe as a paladin, you believe that as that you can steer the resources and the thrust of your Hell Knight order more toward good than evil, because with only a few exceptions, the Hell Knights are a lawful, neutral organization. They take inspiration from Hell, and they like to think that they, you know, use devils as their soldiers and not the other way around. But a paladin could certainly say, I see this lawful organization, which may be misguided in its inspiration, as a tool through which I can bring both good and order to the world. And I like playing characters that are in morally gray areas, or who aren't morally gray but are in a morally gray situation where their morality is really tested. I think that if you're playing character who is never challenged by that, then it doesn't really matter what character you're playing. You're just a bunch of numbers at that point. You know, you're not, you don't have as many role-playing opportunities as you do when you're put in difficult situations. So I like, James really liked that.
It's fun to have those character-defining moments and decisions that when you have those decisions that come up and you look at them and you say, okay, I could see my character doing either one of these things, and whichever one I choose is really going to steer how they go. Because, I mean, characters, they really grow and evolve as we play them, and, you know, unless, even if you're playing every day, like, your view of the character is going to be a little bit different each day, and so, and develop organically. And so those sorts of decisions can really serve as a crossroads for that process.
And you might decide at some point that it's more important for your character to be a Hell Knight than to be a Paladin, at which point you're making the decision to willfully fall. Or the opposite, that it's more important for you to stay true to your Paladin code than it is to stay true to the rack and, or the measure, the measure in the chain.
Yeah.
Are the bylaws basically of the Hell Knights, to say, you know, Iomide is more important than the Hell Knights, and then maybe you're kicked out of the Hell Knights. I mean, that sounds like I would want you to tell me about that character, you know, which I very rarely say, by the way. So you know, like, that's got a cool character hook.
Any thoughts on this, Adam?
I don't talk about alignment in polite company.
Okay.
I'm here. It's not polite company.
Fair enough.
All right. It looks like we have another internet question.
Another internet one? Yeah.
Mandalo from Twitch. Are the Pathfinders going to be looking for stuff in a worldscape? Maybe sending the new Pathfinder hopefuls to check it out?
Are the Pathfinders going to be looking for things in the worldscape? Or maybe sending new Pathfinder hopefuls to check it out?
I think you're best suited to answer this.
Yeah,
one.
I mean, is it a question about the Pathfinder Society as an organized play?
Pathfinders as a whole.
Yeah, I mean, I think
we don't have any particular plans to go into the worldscape with society.
Yeah, I mean, the Pathfinder Society sort of has their own version of the worldscape that's very central to this next season that Linda will probably be better at answering. But in terms of using the worldscape that we've already said in the comics, that's a really weird IP issue for us to navigate, because while we probably own the name worldscape and the concept, we can't publish Red Sonja or Tarzan or, you know, John Carter in our role-playing materials. We can publish stats for them in a Dynamite book because Dynamite owns or has a license from, you know, Robert E. Howard's estate and, you know, what's his name? Who did Tarzan? Yeah, Burroughs. You know, the Burroughs Foundation and all that stuff to be able to do comic content. So for us to do a Pathfinder product that wasn't a comic in the worldscape would need to leave out a lot of what makes the worldscape what it is. Without us needing to jump through a bunch of legal hoops that I'm not sure we want or are willing to jump through. But if you can't adventure in the worldscape, you can still
go to the Haljin Tapestry. So, I mean, now that you're bringing it up, I hadn't really thought about how similar they were before. The idea that you have this demiplane, you have this fantastically powerful, like, mythic, magical person who builds this demiplane by pulling a bunch of things together for their own inscrutable purposes, and lots of cultures and groups from different time periods and different things all blend together, and then mysteriously disappears.
Yeah.
Like, it really is...
it is very similar, yeah.
I
think Eric stole the idea of the worldscape from me when I came up with the Haljin Tapestry storyline, what, season 3? Season 4? I don't remember.
Although speaking of fantastically powerful spellcasters, what's going on with Haljin is something we might be able to get more into in this next season. And Haljin, and what we know, and Haljin's knowledge and things like that.
And for those who are unfamiliar, Hao Jin was a sorcerer in Goka who was, she was called the Ruby Phoenix because she had red hair, and there were tons and tons of attempts to assassinate her because she had this incredible collection of stuff both in and beyond Galarian, and no one could kill her, and then she disappeared and bequeathed all her stuff to a tournament. And in any case, we've done a lot with her over the over the years.
Yeah.
And the Hao Jin tapestry is a demiplane that she had to keep, the really big stuff that she couldn't keep in her house, like mountains and cities and things like that. So she'll be coming back. So while Nex might not, Hao Jin, coming back is the wrong word. She will.
There's definitely going to be more information about what happened with Hao Jin, and more revealed about Hao Jin's secrets and Hao Jin's knowledge. Yes.
So, with the playtest, there have been some lore changes. For example, the Bard is now in cult class.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else like that that has maybe influenced anything that you guys have published since you've been working on Pathfinder 2?
So the question was, with the playtest, the Bard is now in a cult class. The second part was, does that influence how we think about things as we work on stuff toward Pathfinder 2? For me personally, when I first heard the Bard was in a cult class, I was thinking, I'm not sure how that works. But then when you look at the occult spell list for the playtest, how it really is the list that focuses on the things of the mind, the Bard does seem like a natural fit for that. So I don't know, at least personally, if that's has as much of an influence in how I'm thinking about the concept of the Bard, but it's certainly something that would be worth exploring.
Has there been other stuff that maybe inspired anything?
I think loosening alignment restrictions on classes has been really helpful. It allows us to tell stories however we want, instead of having someone, you know, like go, this druid is totally not acting in alignment of...
That's Adam mocking all of the people on our message
you.
Boards, by the way. Oh, that was me. Oh, that's right. That's Adam mocking me, because I sound like that.
No, that's an example.
Are we pushing up our glasses now?
Yeah, I am. Yeah.
Yeah.
See, left out.
Well, actually,
you can put
yeah.
Glasses?
Okay. Well, I mean, are you nearsighted? Do you wear contacts, or you just have perfect vision? No. Okay.
Well, for now, I'm 42 years old, but
okay. Off topic.
Yeah, fair enough. But did you have anything you've inspired with that? Like, it's
well, I mean, so one thing to keep in mind with the playtest is that it is a playtest, and we're not doing it, other than Doomsday Dawn four scenarios.
Yes,
over
four
the course
scenarios.
Of the over the course of the next few months, we're not doing playtest content. So the Bard may not end up being an occult class. I mean, the fundamentals of spellcasting could completely change between today and when we send the final Pathfinder 2nd edition book to the printer. And so we're sort of looking at it from the world standpoint in the same way that everyone, you know, a lot of other people are looking at it from a rules standpoint, is, okay, if we do this, how does it change the world? What is the impact? I think in regards to the Bard, I don't think that people in Galarian know what a spell list is. They don't, you know, they don't know what the difference, they might know that there is a difference between people who get their power from a divine source and people who use study or something in their blood, but the definition of occult and divine and arcane is really a tool that we as game designers use to relay information and to organize things so that people can all play under the same assumptions of how the world works. But how someone in Galarian, they know what a bard is. They know bards sing songs and dance and, you know, make other people, you know, enthralled. But they probably don't know much more than that. And so I think that a lot of the fundamental changes, I know people have asked, at PaizoCon, people asked a similar question about resonance, which is sort of your innate pool of magical power that you use to interact with magic items. And it's like, well, you know, to the average person in Galarian who doesn't have 20 ranks in Knowledge Arcana, they know that if they put this ring on, that they're a little bit harder to hit, or if they wear this cloak, that they can drink a little bit more poison, you know, and that doesn't equate, you know, maybe they've always had resonance and it just wasn't reflected in the previous rules. I mean, we don't really delve into that from a setting standpoint. So
what you're saying is if I go into a magic shop, it's not going to say plus one cloak of resistance on the hanger.
It depends on your GM.
But also,
you know?
Furthermore, one of the things, like when the design team first started working on the playtest rules for the second edition, way, way back, one of the things that was given was we need to still be able to tell the stories that we've been telling, and we need to make sure the rules don't invalidate the stories we've already told.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there needs to be a sync up, and I think the design team did a great job.
I think they did a great job, and you know, part of their design process was coming around to the rest of the staff who, I mean, they were largely, you know, heads down collaborating with one another, but they made a lot of effort to come out to the rest of the development staff or the editorial staff or the art staff or whomever and say, hey, when you think of bards, what do you think? Or, hey, we're thinking of doing the bard as an occult class. What's your reaction? And I think for the most part, the design team is in step enough with the folks working on adventures and setting material that there were very few instances, I think, maybe the can paladins be anything but lawful good, where we didn't have a very clear majority just saying, yeah, that sounds cool. There were a few things where it was maybe 50-50, but so that was definitely part of their process as well. So hopefully there won't be very many things where we have to address them in the setting in a way that feels forced.
So we're running down on time here. I think we have time for one more question, maybe two. Yes, up in the front.
I'm running Strange Eons right now, and I got through Rain of Winter in the past. I was wondering, do you have any particular hard and fast rules, or just, you know, things that you tend to do when intersecting Galarian with Earth?
So the question is that you've run Rain of Winter in the past, you're doing Strange Eons now, and do we have any particular hard and fast rules that we use when intersecting Galarian with Earth?
One thing is know the subject matter. Brandon Hodge, who's here at the show, wrote the Rasputin Must Die adventure, and he researched the hell out of that. Like, that monastery is actually based on a floor plan of a monastery in Siberia, very near where we hint that it's located. Just knowing that really well, I got off a little easier with the mention of the Paris Nexus in Carcosa, because it's in Carcosa and it's not really Paris. It's a weird, you know, messed up version of it. So I could play around a little bit more.
But in Strange Eons, there's also like, there are people that you encounter that are either from Earth or have more of a connection
to
Earth.
They're all fictional, though.
Abdullah Hazard isn't real?
No.
What? Are you telling me the Necronomicon's made up, too?
Eric Zahn is not real?
Yeah. What? But I hear his music all the time.
But also in that same thing is just knowing the source material and just, like, really paying attention to that and making sure that it works and doesn't say the wrong thing.
It's a rabbit hole for sure. I mean, you could end up researching, you know, Paris and when does that 1930s Paris or 20s Paris? Yeah, 20s. I mean, you could go down a huge rabbit hole looking into, you know, post World War I Paris to make it so real. One, are your players going to even know? Do they want to play in the real world? I mean, we've always said that the version of Earth that we include in adventures is our Earth. It's not alternate Earth. It's not. So we always try and make them as true to life as we can. But at the same time, you can play games that are set on Earth that get maps wrong and, you know, that make things up. I mean, there's still fiction in our world. So, yeah, it's really up to you.
All right. We are out of time, but I will be hanging around for a little bit. I don't know if you two have the time for that. Just after this to answer some additional questions. Thank you all for coming to Secrets of Galarian.
Yeah, I got
to
see what my schedule says, but yeah.
Yeah, we're all at the booth, you know, for the next 3 days. So if you have additional questions, you can find us or anyone else in a blue shirt, and most of them will send you to us to answer those questions.